Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest tonight is Lucy Wyatt. For people who've been listening into our show last week, they will have heard us do an update on a conference I attended 2 weeks ago now, Megalithomania. And on the first day, one of the speakers who so impressed me, who in fact I think stole the show on the first day out of all the speakers, was Lucy Wyatt. Because Lucy is going back to the roots of civilization and has not only uncovered new and interesting aspects about the roots of civilization, but really has given all of that material over to a book which is called Approaching Chaos. And Approaching Chaos is basically a book which says that many, many millennia ago, certain things happened, and we should really take note of those things. So Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Philip. Hi.
Hi there. First of all, give us some background, if you can, as to what made you decide to write this book.
It really grew out of an interest in alternative medicine, particularly homeopathy. My issue was is that a lot of my, as it were, mainstream friends who are doctors were very dismissive of homeopathy as non-scientific. And I felt that by going back to its origins, like ancient Greece, I might find a different story. And it was as I was kind of digging around in that story that I discovered that there was a bigger picture, a bigger issue to be explored to do with civilization. And that was a good 10 or 12 years ago, and that's really where I started. So it was a kind of side product, byproduct, if you like.
And really, when we look at civilization, we think that this is like an evolution, that it started out very basically, very simple, and then really that it evolved from there and that it ends where we are now and that we're at the pinnacle of civilization. We've gone to the moon, we have internet, we have all of these gadgets. But you're actually saying that certain things at the root of civilization are A, not clearly explained by science, but also that there's definitely material there which we should really take a look at, because along the lines, it seems we might have lost certain things.
Yeah, I'm saying that what's happened is that we've been told, we're telling ourselves the wrong story. We're telling ourselves that cities grew out of some kind of farming experiment, and that it all relates to changes in agriculture. And I'm saying that when you really look at the evidence, when you go back to the end of the Ice Age, you know, more than 12,000 years ago, that story doesn't actually stack up. And I'm saying that in my view, it's just as likely, if not more likely, that the changes that did occur in agriculture occurred because of the cities and not the other way around. So I've tried to take a very practical, pragmatic approach to things. I've looked at hard evidence, the hard archaeological evidence, as well as taking in some things to do with DNA changes and that kind of thing to arrive at the conclusions that I've arrived at. And I think we have been misled, or we've misled ourselves.
In your lecture, one of the things which jumped out at me, and I hope I'm quoting you correctly, is this idea that science seems to have that you take a wild animal, you play around with it, so to speak, and then it becomes a domesticated animal, and then all is fine. But you were pointing out that you have experience of animals, and that this is such an oversimplification, and that's simply not true.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the point is that when you go back into the historic record, there were two distinct phases of farming. One, a very early simple one where cereals were changed, but animals weren't, and animals were kept penned up for meat and hides, but they weren't sufficiently docile to take milk from and use for things. And that phase went on for thousands of years. I mean, if this was an evolutionary process, then surely after time those would have changed. No, there was a very distinct change which occurred with animals several thousands of years later, which coincides with the arrival of cities. That's what makes me also very suspicious that it was deliberate. And the thing is if you know anything about breeding, you know that if you want to get a different outcome, you have to breed something with something different. Otherwise, you get more of the same. I mean, the point is we have wolves in zoos and they have not evolved into dogs, for example. You know, we haven't tamed them so that they suddenly become man's best friend. They continue to be wolves that are born in zoos. But when these changes in agricultural animals happened, these domesticated animals happened, they did change in size, they changed in characteristic, they changed in appearance. And this key thing about docility, which I don't think you can sit around a waterhole and look at aurochs, which are supposed to be precursor to the cow, and work out with hindsight what is going to make a good cow and what's going to be a docile auroch. It would kill you. And as I said in my lecture, we have on the farm everything that can kill you, bulls, horses, you name it. But the point is something has changed in their heads that make them easy to handle. And the key thing that changes at about 5,000 BC, at the same time as cities, is what the archaeologists call the secondary products revolution in agriculture. And that's when all of a sudden you can take milk from a cow and make secondary products like butter and cheese. And the thing that lots of people do not realize is that you can suddenly take the wool from a deer. Before that, from a sheep, rather. Before that, sheep had coats like deer, and you couldn't use their coats. It wasn't wool. Even though people have been eating sheep for thousands of years, there's plenty of evidence of ancient bones of sheep. But the sheep was not sufficiently modified until that point. I mean, this is so, so important. These are things that really should not be ignored.
Absolutely. And so the big question then is, what is it about cities that changed this?
Well, the point about cities is that cities create interdependence. They have a need to have specific people in specific places doing specific jobs, division of labor, if you remember your basic economics. A city can't survive without that. Whereas if you're a hunter-gatherer, everybody in the tribe can be involved in some aspect of food production, for example. In a city, you can't do that. If you're spending all day doing administration or whatever, you can't be out there in the fields planting your food. So cities need agriculture. They need that change to happen. And the other keynote, key word to bear in mind is convenience. The point about having domesticated animals and having domesticated cereals, it's all about convenience. You don't have to go traveling to look for it. And that's also a very fundamental change that happens.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about in regard to all this is the subtitle of your book, because the book is called Approaching Chaos. And the subtitle, which I think is really important, is Could an Ancient Archetype Save 21st Century Civilization? And I was really struck by that. And as I started reading through some of the articles and some of the information on your website, what I saw I was really grabbed by was this phrase you use, eco-suicide, that we are facing eco-suicide in the 21st century because our urban way of life is destroying our own life support system on the planet. And I want to kind of go back to that for a minute. And everything you're talking about with the way the domestication of animals, what was happening with agriculture, that we're really being forced to look at the idea of progress differently. Like, are we making progress or are we in fact regressing? And was the progress really what was happening in these ancient cultures who understood how to live in a zero carbon technology? So I would love to have you talk a little bit about that concept.
Well, the point is that the very original cities who did live according to the principles of the archetype, they knew how to live in harmony with nature. That's the point. And the problem for us, for various historical reasons which we can go into, we've become disconnected with that whole way of thinking. So we get the benefits, as it were. We get the domesticated animals and we get the infrastructure and we get the cities, but we haven't continued to respect the harmony with nature bit. We didn't understand the oneness that actually the ancients did have. I mean, the point about the archetype is what I'm referring to there is stuff to do with the subconscious, stuff to do with out-of-body experiences, with the whole shamanic ritual. And that is, in my view, how the cities came about, as I don't think that that it's true to say there was an evolved thing. They didn't grow out organically and randomly out of marketplaces, out of exchanging agricultural surplus. They were pre-planned. They were artificial constructs that were put into the landscape from the beginning. They are properly surveyed and laid out, but they still were corresponded to this like a Platonic ideal of this archetype. So that's why you see the same principles in so many different locations around the world and so many different time zones, because the people in the Mayan or whoever it is, the Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Phoenicians or whoever it is, knew how to tap into that archetype. That's my point. And that's the thing I think we need to reconnect with, because it wasn't ecological suicide at that point.
So how do we go to that point? Specifically, let's take it back to the creation of cities. You say there's no such thing as a growth. And definitely when you look at civilizations like the Indus Valley, Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, you can clearly see how these cities were designed along a very straightforward, planned nature. So what is this? Why are they doing this? How did that happen? Why do people say, oh, let's create a city? What is that archetype for you?
Yeah, I mean, the motive I don't actually understand. I don't know what the motive is. I mean, all I can really comment on is that it happened and that we're living in a certain twisted consequences of it. And it's the twisted consequence that kind of interests me, because we've warped it and abused it and now we're paying a price. So I'm saying let's reconnect with the original. But why the original happened, I don't have any idea that I can put, because what I have to say is I was very concerned to base my book on firm evidence, on archaeological evidence. So that's why I don't talk about Atlantis, I don't talk about Lemuria, I don't talk about these things. I mean, that's not to say that they didn't exist or they weren't important, but I haven't actually found the firm evidence that points to where these things were. So it's possible that I'm fairly convinced that there were elites around. I'm fairly convinced that they probably were the people with the elongated skulls. And I did actually delete that from the book where I did discuss people with the elongated skulls. And they may well have been people from other planets. I've no idea. But the point is that these were the people who wanted to create cities and knew how to do it. And the point is that the concepts which they introduced were very, how can I say, complete. You know, it's a very full concept. It's not a thing that just grows from one little idea. It arrives as a totality. That's my point.
Absolutely. And I was actually in preparation for an article reading a book about a French camp which was created in the middle of nowhere, really, in the Netherlands, whereby French soldiers were deployed there around 1804. And you can see how enormously difficult it is to basically get, you know, several hundred, in that case thousands of people just going in a place where no provisions have been made and no planning has been made. An awful lot of these people, for example, became ill because of things, basic things lacking. So the idea of creating cities is not as simple even in the 19th century as it was then, or even today. But you've already been hinting at it, and you write about it as well. You definitely see shamanism as being involved in the creation of cities.
Yeah, absolutely. Because what one of the things that interested me was this whole thing to do with scientific knowledge. And we seem to have this idea that you arrive at scientific knowledge through experimentation. So one thing leads to another and you try things out and you test them, objectivity, subjectivity, all that kind of thing. But I don't think that that's how the ancients arrived at stuff. I think the whole point is that through their ability to do these out-of-body experiences, that's how they knew what they knew, and they knew it instantly. There was no experimentation. And for some reason, nobody seems to have picked up on this, particularly in the fact that the pharaohs and other people to do with the ancient cities were themselves shaman. and that there were certain rituals that they experienced, and the shamanic language is apparent in the coffin text and the pyramid text, for example, and also in this particular thing called the Hebsed Festival, which has very definitely an out-of-body aspect to it if you interpret it in a certain way. But for some reason, we think of shaman as just people in the Siberian steppes or Mongolian steppes or Peruvian jungle, you know, kind of medicine men. We don't realize that it has this very sophisticated aspect to it, and that these city builders also knew these techniques. So for some reason, that just hasn't kind of registered with people, which I find very, very strange. You know, it's kind of putting it all together, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, you've touched upon one of the top favorite subjects of mine, which is the Hebsed Festival and shamanism. So by all accounts, Lucy, go on at liberty. What is so interesting about the Hebsed Festival and shamanism?
Well, for a start, to take, for example, even the name Pharaoh, as far as I am aware, so much of what we understand about Egypt comes through the Greeks. And if the Greeks got it right, then we get the correct information. But quite often the Greeks didn't quite understand things. And my understanding is that the word Pharaoh is a Greek interpretation of the words Per-Ur. And as you may remember from my lecture, I make a lot about this word Ur, which I think has this sense of foundation. And Per Ur means house of foundation. And it was the place where the king of Egypt, the pharaoh, went to be initiated. So that's kind of interesting in itself. And one of the locations that's been identified is that place, Nekhen or Hieranochopolis, which has got this mysterious fort. Anyway, so the thing that's really key for a pharaoh is what they call his Hebsed festival, his jubilee. And so much is created for the pharaoh for this very big event, which is really the rededication of the country of Egypt to civilization. And that's why so many pharaohs built their own pyramids and built their Hebsed festival courts. There is a view that there are possibly some remnants of Hebsed festival imagery even leading to the Great Pyramid at Giza, but because of our misinterpretation and our thinking that coffins mean a burial place for a dead person, because in the 19th century when Flinders Petrie, the Victorian archaeologist, was discovering the pyramid text inside Saqqara and places that talks about the journey of the pharaoh's soul, he assumed it meant the pharaoh's soul in death. But actually, Dr. Jeremy Nadler, an Oxford academic, is just as convinced that this is about the pharaoh's soul in life, and that he's actually describing his shamanic journey during the Osirian rites. And the Osirian rites are about the metaphorical, literally, dismemberment of Osiris and his resurrection 3 days later at the hands of Isis. And when the pharaoh, during the Hebsed festival, enters the realm of Saqqara in the pyramid and he is ritually buried for 3 days, that's what he is doing. So I'm really trying to be like a forensic detective and looking at circumstantial evidence and trying to piece it together to make a coherent story. And I think in the past, we didn't necessarily have the tools for understanding these things. People didn't understand about shamanism. We were so wrapped up with our whole kind of Catholic Christian religion thing, and we didn't understand about death or reincarnation or the role of the spirit, or we didn't know about the ka or the ba, these aspects of the soul. And it's only really as people have got into India and then they've understood about auras and the fact that the soul can take on these aspects, and that our whole kind of approach has changed. That's what I would say. Is that enough about Hebsed Festival?
Absolutely. And just for our listeners, I want to point out that we're actually Jeremy Nadler and I have been trying to get Jeremy on a radio show and in front of an audience, but Jeremy is unfortunately extremely shy. And even though he considers coming, even though he considered at one point coming on a radio show when I told him it was really just two people, he still kind of like couldn't get himself to commit to that. So for all the Jeremy Nadler material, please read his books. I think his most recent one is actually something with future. It's a synopsis of several of his articles, but his best known one is definitely Shamanism in the Pyramid Texts, and it's a book which I think anybody actually has to read because it is it's very interesting. And he also points out a way as to why, for example, Snefru might have had three pyramids. And pyramids is a subject you're interested in as well, and basically you feel that there is a very specific purpose to pyramids, which has nothing to do with just tombs.
With just, sorry, what did you say? With just...
just tombs.
What, being buried, you mean?
Yes.
Just tombs. Absolutely. Oh, quite. Well, this is because we have this very, very limited understanding of what a tomb is, especially in this terms of these rituals. I mean, I have no doubt that a pyramid can have multifunctions. I'm sure of that, and I'm sure the sighting of it is very important from a geomantic point of view. I have no doubt, no quarrel with that. I slightly don't quite totally go down the whole Chris Dunn thing in terms of it being generating power for use elsewhere, as it were. I mean, I do think it's very specific and restricted to aspects of ritual. And I thought that Semir Osmanagic's presentation at Megalithomania was very interesting on the Bosnian pyramid, because I can see distinct parallels between that and what would have gone on at the Giza pyramid. So I do think that we have perhaps underestimated the importance of ritual in all of this. And this was ritual with a purpose. You know, I don't think people just did things just for their own sake, which is what we do a lot of with our own religious things. I think that the pharaohs went on these journeys, these out-of-body journeys, to find concrete information so that they would know practical ways of helping to keep civilization intact. You know, I don't think it's just about personal spiritual growth or anything like that. I think it had a very, very practical aspect to it.
Absolutely. They were seen to be as this bridge between our world and the world of the gods, wasn't it? And it's again, I guess it's once again an example of how, with maybe the exception of the Pope, none of the other leaders really in this world are at all regarded as having a role in that. They are just there to basically lead us, so to speak, but that vast wealth of shamanic culture, where they weren't at the pinnacle, but actually were at the lower end of divinity, so to speak, is definitely something which once again has drifted away. And I assume this might be one of the factors as to why some of the good things about early civilization have ebbed away as well, why we are in the 21st century in the situation we're in.
Well, I think the really important thing to say about ancient shamanic ritual, or even modern-day shamanic ritual, is this is stuff that's done on behalf of a community. This is when an individual takes a huge risk with their own life, because it's quite easy, it's quite possible to actually physically die during such, they're dangerous, these out-of-body experiences, but it's done for the sake of the community. That's the point. And the thing is that it's not surprising it ebbed away or disappeared, is because I think that, especially the Egyptians, they did not want their secrets to fall into the wrong hands. They did not want already very powerful groups like the Romans to actually know how to do shamanic ritual. And so I think it's not at all surprising that we've lost touch with all of that, because the Romans were quite powerful enough without knowing these inner secrets. And I think it's no coincidence that the Nazis, for example, were very interested in discovering about this kind of thing too. And thank goodness, hopefully they didn't find out. I mean, a friend of mine once said to me, oh, well, if the Egyptians were so clever, why didn't they drop big stones on the heads of the Romans when the Romans invaded Egypt? Well, the point is, by that point, the Egyptians were no longer Egyptian. They were Greek. They were Greek Ptolemies who actually controlled Egypt. The secrets had already started to go underground at that point. And the link was alchemy. And I, as you may remember from my talk, I have a particular take on what alchemy is all about.
Well, you're reading my mind because it was my next question. I've been sitting here saying, okay, I've got to ask her about alchemy because we talk about it a lot on this show. And I was excited to see it. It shows up in a lot of places on your website and in the index of your book and, I mean, the contents of your book. So I would love for you to talk about what your perspective on alchemy is within this context, because I think that people who are listening would find that very exciting.
Sure. Well, the thing about alchemy, again, I go back to this point I've already made, that it's through the Greeks. The Greeks are our means of understanding this. And my feeling is, my belief is that the Greeks confused a process with an outcome. I think that they got very close to the Egyptians, and they got so that they observed all sorts of aspects of the Egyptian rituals. But I don't think they were ever actually revealed to them what the final secrets were. So what's come down to us through the Greeks is that alchemy is to do with something to do with gold and something to do with transmutation. Now, people often focus on alchemy as being about personal spiritual transformation. I think it's more than that. I think it really is to do with this shamanic ritual. I think it's a physical process. And what I think happened was, is the Greeks were aware of this change of gold into a white powder, the philosopher's stone, and using various means to achieve that. But what they didn't find out was what that powder was used for. And I think it was used in the Hetep ritual meal, which is part of the Hepsed festival. And it was the solar bread. And I think that the pharaoh used that as his means of getting into his trance, as means of his getting into his out-of-body experience. And so what's happened is that because we don't know what the word alchemy means, we haven't realized that it could relate to the Egyptian word for the fixed stars, the imperishable northern stars, which are called in Egyptian the chemi. And to me, that's just like, well, that's just so obvious. That's obviously what it's all about. But because the Greeks didn't know that, they've just stuck with this change of gold. And people have said, oh, chem means the black lands. Well, that doesn't make any sense either. But it does make sense when you put it into this context of astral planing, of out-of-body experiences, and using gold, which in this white powdered form has these levitational properties to it. So that's what I think the real meaning of alchemy is. It's about the shamanic process.
And how much do you go into this in your book? Is this in Approaching Chaos?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's all in there, and I describe in great detail about the pharaoh combining the ka and the ba, which is the two aspects of his soul, and uniting and becoming an ark, which is the phoenix or heron creature. And I go into enormous detail in the book. I mean, because I think it's really important that people completely change their attitude towards Egypt, that we don't see it as primitive and backward, and that we do understand, you know, what these things actually mean and what it is that we've lost contact with. So, no, there's a lot of detail in there, definitely.
I can't wait to read it, and I just want to say, and we'll say this again at the end, that we will be putting all this information up on our website, all the connections, so that people can get to your book right away through Amazon and through other channels, because I would actually like to go and read it immediately. So I know I'm not going to be the only one who is going to be dying to get their hands on this book as soon as they listen to you, because it's so – the work that you've done is it's so thorough, and it's so smart, and it's so exciting. And in talking about – the brilliance of the Egyptians, another thing that you have said on your website that I love, and I'd like you to just elaborate on it a little bit, is this idea that everything we think we're learning now about quantum physics, so much of it really goes back to the Hermetica.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is part of our problem with thinking ourselves as being so progressive and so advanced and all the rest of it. And I mean, I haven't actually totally nailed all the evidence, but I have a very strong suspicion that they did have some big, strong feelings about submolecular stuff, that they knew how to connect with it. And I have a feeling that that is part of the secret of how they moved the big stones. You know, stuff to do with resonance, to do with vibration. And there are comments in the Hermetica that kind of make one feel that they understood the importance of these things and knew how to manipulate them. That's the point. They knew how to manipulate physics, and we still haven't discovered that secret of how to move the big stones. We're still stuck in a way of thinking it was all about thousands of slaves and this kind of really very limited thinking. Whereas the evidence which is there in Egypt shows that the where they've excavated the villages of the pyramid workers, those pyramid workers were very well treated. They were not treated as slaves. They had the best cuts of meat. They had medical treatment. They didn't necessarily live there all the time. They were seasonal workers. It's a Roman Greek kind of Hollywood interpretation of thousands of slaves being cracked whips and chains and all of that. And when you think at the time when the Great Pyramid at Giza was built, this was the Copper Age. This wasn't the Iron Age. Copper was the strongest material that they had. And you can't cut a heavy stone like granite with copper. And the rope that they would have had would be hemp rope. Well, a system is only as strong as its weakest link. And it doesn't matter how much force you put on the other end. It's not necessarily going to pull something that weighs 50 tons, 500 miles. So there had to be another technique. It's common sense, isn't it? It's logic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, the title of your book is called Approaching Chaos. And for our listeners who've been listening to this for roughly 30 minutes, they'll kind of go, but why did Lucy call her book Approaching Chaos? What is it that about Approaching Chaos that is so important that it became the title of your book?
Well, what I've done, Philip, is to try and do a massive overview from the end of the Ice Age up to the modern day, because my starting point is the modern day. My starting point is that we are facing increasing chaos in our modern lives. And, you know, who knows what it is that's going to really push us over the edge? I mean, who even knows where Japan is going to end up? Third largest economy in the world, you know, Fukushima and all the rest of it. How long is it going to take them to dig themselves out of that one? And if, for example, in the West, we experienced a repeat of the 1859 Carrington event, which I don't know your listeners are aware, which is a massive mass ejection, coronal mass ejection from the sun, which would create a huge electromagnetic storm and wipe out our national power grids for 4 to 10 years. I mean, just imagine the chaos. I mean, our civilization would collapse. So my point is that if we are serious about wanting to live a decent, civilized life, you know, involving cities and all the rest of it, let's reconsider the ancient past. We can rebuild. We can take on board their principles, and their principles have the advantage of respecting nature, of being in harmony with nature. That's really my point. So I'm saying that a massive catastrophe that we could be facing now could be our opportunity. So my message is really optimistic. You know, even though it would be very grim to live through something that's 10 times, how many times worse than Hurricane Katrina or whatever the ghastliness is, that at the end of the day, we could actually come out of this stronger, better, happier, more fulfilled, and love our beautiful blue planet, which, after all, you know, enjoy each other's company and enjoy being here. It's a beautiful place. Why do we want to keep on trashing it? You know, that's really my problem.
And you really walk this talk. That's the other thing I want to say. You have done some extraordinary things in your own life, in your personal life, in terms of where you live with your family, how you have renovated this home, this farm that you live on, how you have restored it with eco materials and that type of thing. Can you talk to us a little bit about how this works in your life every day?
Well, one of the as it were, most important things is I have my own water supply. I'm very lucky in that I draw water 60 foot out of the ground. And so this place has been an amazing opportunity because it was unspoiled. It was empty for 40 years. The house had never had electricity. And so one of the things I had to put in was a whole new sewage system. And it was a chance to explore very much that kind of living in harmony with nature. So I was able to put in a 3-pond sewage system that uses reeds and gravel to recycle all our human domestic waste and take it back into nature without polluting the ground. So that's been a very satisfying, and it's been going for 7, 8, 9 years. There's no smell. It's very beautiful to look at. There's 8 ducklings that have just hatched on it and are swimming around. I have very non-toxic poo, as you could imagine. and we've done things like capture our rainwater and using ecologically based natural plant-based paints and all our building material as far as we can. I mean, yes, there is some compromise, but I've tried to raise the bar and minimize my compromise, because the thing that I find so offensive is anything to do with plastic, anything to do with vinyl or poly or anything like that, because this to me is the biggest offense that modern man has created for the planet, is these long chain plastics which don't biodegrade, which don't break down, and I find them very distressing. So even stuff that is in the ground that you can't see, I've tried to use clay pipes, I've used cast iron, stainless steel, copper, whatever it is, stuff that you can reuse, you can mend, or will come, you know, out of the earth, clay, you know, those materials I have tried to use wherever I possibly can, because I do feel so strongly about it. You know, to me, that's what is integrity, is when you can't see something, you know, you cut it, it's all the way, the same all the way through. Yeah.
And you also, the other thing that I think is beautiful about what you're saying and how you live is that you're not saying that this is a sacrifice. You're not in any way inconvenienced by going this extra step to use these types of sustainable materials. And it's been quite the opposite, really. It's becomes kind of a joyous experience for you.
Oh, completely. There's no hair shirt around here. I mean, we live a very comfortable life. And no, we don't kind of suffer in any way. This is my point. My point is that there are alternative ways of living that are very civilized and that are very comfortable. And our ancient ancestors knew these things. You know, they could live a sophisticated life. And I'm very much in favor of that. Now, I'm not kind of dug out in a cave in a side of a hill and, you know, carting wood and that kind of thing. No, it's very much modern life, but modern life hopefully with a bit more sensitivity. That's the point. And I mean, it isn't easy, because obviously there is a whole business about materials. I mean, yes, I mentioned things like copper, and you know, there is a huge world global demand for that kind of thing. So I mean, I'm not necessarily the only answer, but you know, at least it's one step in a certain direction.
Absolutely. And if you were to be given the power, let's say you become either the mayor of New York or London, or the queen or president of Britain and America, what would be your first steps? And also, to some extent, even without that power at your hand, what would be the message to the world as Lucy Wyatt?
Well, the really key one is the ecological one, isn't it? I mean, that's just so, so important. And I think the whole thing is about a change of philosophy that's needed. One of the things that I write about in the book is this distinction between the Romans, who for them the end justified the means, and we have continued with that mentality. You know, when we build a new motorway or airline runway, we say the destruction is justified by the economic prosperity that it brings, and that to me is a very destructive way of thinking. Mm-hmm. What the ancients had, the Egyptians or whoever it was that how you do something is as important as why you do it. And the Native Americans had this idea, we are of the earth and part of the earth. I quote Marcus Aurelius at the end of my book, where he talks about everything being part of a web, that what you do to one part of the web has an impact on another part of the web. So if we could change people's way of thinking, then I think their actions would change. And if we realize how important this beautiful blue planet is to us, then we would want to make her look beautiful with sacred geometry. We would want to make her work properly so that we're not being so destructive, that we respected animals and that animals have souls, and whether domesticated or not, we wouldn't be locking them up in ghastly intensive farming things, and we would have enough to eat. You know, this is the point about the ancient civilization archetype, is it was still organized. It was still irrigation and all the rest of it, but it was done with respect. That's the point, and that's the bit that's missing really from what we have today.
And if I can take you back to a historical question on all this, one of the things that you said in your website materials that really grabbed me, because this is something that I write a lot about and I have a great fascination with, as I know my readers do. One of the things that you said was that this archetype, or aspects of this archetype of living, reemerged at the time of the Gothic cathedrals. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you see that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing is that we did start to reconnect a bit, and that's really through the Hermetica. It's partly because they had this idea that there was some knowledge out there that was older than Noah, so they kind of sent people on missions looking for it. And I think that when Egypt collapsed and stuff went underground in about the 4th century AD, it went up the trade routes to Syria, and it went particularly to this city of Haran, where there were lots of alchemists, Sabians who were alchemists, people who understood about this out-of-body stuff. And it somehow, it can be short-circuited as being the Hermetica. And the Hermetica was absorbed by Islam. Islam came to kind of protect it, which is why you see this incredible flowering of civilization and civilizing arts at the time when Islam is really taking hold. And Islam was in that area of Haran and in that area of Syria. So when the Crusades happened and people from the West, particularly these French knights, went to Jerusalem overland, they came into contact with certain Arabs who knew this knowledge to do with Hermetica, who knew about Trismegistus and the Emerald Tablets. And so that's what made them realize there was some fascinating knowledge out there. And I think it's really, really interesting that St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who was the person who wrote the orders for the Knights Templars, who was in Burgundy, that he preached the Second Crusade at Vézelay. He sent them to Edessa, which is right next to Haran in Syria. There was no other reason really to be in San Leo for Edessa, this place he sent them on the Second Crusade, except for the fact that it was right near where these alchemists, these Sabians were. And he's the one that was responsible for inspiring Chartres Cathedral. He's the one that knew Abbot Suger, who built the Gothic bit of the Saint-Denis in Paris. And so those principles of geometry came back, and it's through his influence that they came back through the Knights Templar and the Hermetica. So Gothic cathedrals really are the physical manifestation of this knowledge that they brought back, and they show clear influence of geometry and clear influence of Islamic architecture. That's the extraordinary thing, if you think about it. And they could only have known that by going overland to Jerusalem. Fascinating.
That's fantastic.
Absolutely. And so here we are at the 21st century. But you were kind of like saying, okay, there might be a giant eruption of solar flares which are pushing us back. Are there things which we can actually do? Are there things, again, Lucy Wyatt, Prime Minister, President, what are the things which we can actively do before chaos really descends on us and forces us to adopt a new model of civilization?
Well, we can, I mean, it's an impossible question, isn't it? Because you can only change the world around you. You can't really change the world. So I think as long as you yourself know how to live, and you have your philosophy that makes sense, and you live your life in a certain way. I mean, obviously there are certain skills and techniques that you might want to develop in terms of, you know, growing your own food and that kind of thing. But I think developing some awareness of things like sacred geometry would be good, and understanding, you know, things like feng shui and energy lines and reconnecting with the earth in those terms would would be good, so that if you did need to rebuild yourself something, you could build it along those principles. That would be a very good thing. But I think how you would survive after such a disaster was so much depend on how you had raised your own consciousness and your own awareness before the disaster. You wouldn't go missing your hamburgers and your fried chicken and stuff like that if you've already stopped consuming that kind of thing before the disaster. So I think it's really address your own issues now and ensure that you have that sensitivity, that you do have some respect. And also seek out those shamans who do know how to go out of body. I don't recommend people do it themselves without lots of long training and preparation. And then, you know, in terms of medicine and healing, I mean, I have been very helped myself by homeopathy and herbalism and these kind of things. You know, wean yourself off the pills that come from the chemists, you know, so that you do know what natural, or you know someone else who knows what natural products will help do whatever. And it can still be done in an organized, sophisticated kind of way. It doesn't have to be just nuts and berries and that kind of thing. So I think that one can start to make gradual changes in one's life now and realize that we all have choices and we can start to change how we live now. So that if something ghastly did happen, it wouldn't be easy, but we could survive and we could look long term, definitely. And if there are people who do know how to do the shamanic ritual, then they will know how to access the knowledge and they will know how to get the information. You don't have to have it written down in that sense.
So in your history in approaching chaos, 11,000 years roughly of the adventure that is civilization. We are obviously at the end of 11,000 years, but at the beginning I also said we think we are at the pinnacle of these 11,000 years. Are there actually in those 11,000 years of history and in your research civilizations which are similar to where we are, where you identify the same problems with, and can we learn anything from those civilizations if they are?
Well, Egypt was consistent for such a long period of time. I mean, if you think about it, the Egypt that we know starts at about 3100 BC, and it did descend gradually into more egocentric and megalomania before it actually collapsed and became vulnerable to invasion by Persians. I mean, the first of the Indo-European tribes who invaded in about 600 BC. So I think that our obsession with the ego is probably one of our biggest problems, isn't it? It's a whole thing to do with becoming very, very left-brained, whereas I think that the original ancient societies were more, possibly more right-brained. You know, I don't know if your listeners have ever watched the TED Talks on the internet, and the talk particularly by Jill Nolte Taylor, you know, the neurosurgeon, where she talks about having a stroke. And it's so fascinating because I think that what she's describing is how the Egyptians saw life as this interconnectedness, because they saw life through a right brain way of looking at it. So I do think that in terms of balancing out male, female, recognizing that we have different ways of looking at things and that each are equally important, even though they're different. Understanding the paradoxes in life, you know, that chaos and order are part of the same, two sides of the same coin, you know, just as well as yin and yang are as well. So those are some of the things that I think we're already seeing the shift into that way of thinking.
I think we are too, and I was excited just now to hear you talk about the right brain, left brain thing, because and earlier when you were talking about the Greeks and how the Greeks didn't get it, they didn't have the full story. What my thought at that time, and I actually wrote it down here as a note to ask you, is do you think the Greeks the problematic piece of how the Greeks interpreted what was coming out of Egypt is that they were so cerebral and left-brained about it, as opposed to understanding the Egyptian approach, which was far more creative and heart and spirit and right brain centric. And is that the piece that was missing? Is that where it all starts to diminish and become an incomplete teaching?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that is very much a problem, because if you think about it, there were very strong aspects of Greek society that were highly militaristic. You know, take Spartans or whoever. I mean, they're forever fighting wars with each other, which is one reason why they had such a strong relationship with the Romans, who were the ultimate in military society, really. And yes, I mean, it's true that they wanted everything to be that you could define everything, that you could put it into a certain box, that you could be very very specific about it all, and very mechanical. Their approach is very mechanical, which is why so much of what our early science is very inherited from Aristotle. And you know, we talk about the difference between Newtonian science and modern physics as being very mechanical. They saw, you know, like a big clockwork orange type, you know, clockwork thing. And whereas actually Newton himself, he starts to talk about more going along the lines of quantum physics, this more non-locality type, different approach to things. But I think at that point it became very difficult for religious reasons. And I think that the difficulty that we've had is we've had to develop a scientific method that separates objectivity from subjectivity. Because if you arrived at an answer that you couldn't repeat, that wasn't transparent, you could be accused of being in league with the devil and lose your life. And that's still a little bit of a problem today, if you think about it. You know, things aren't taken seriously if they're arrived at in a different method, this more intuitive method. So there's strong historical reasons why we're still very dominated by whole Roman, Greek, cerebral, left brain way of thinking about things, definitely.
But you do feel, as I do, I believe, that we are getting, that we are moving forward finally, that we are actually progressing toward an understanding of bringing ourselves back into the importance of the right brain and how to integrate that into these things that we normally think of as traditional logical processes. We
absolutely
are making strides.
Absolutely. Quantum physics has completely blown the lid off it. I mean, even someone who regards himself as the ultimate in logical person, Richard Dawkins, even he describes quantum physics as mysterious. I mean, he can't kind of really put it into a logical box. And I think that they have enormous difficulty in integrating how they see quantum physics with how they want to be able to control the world. And the point is they can't. I mean, chaos theory, it's brilliant. It's all about being unable to control, that from tiny, tiny events, huge consequences develop over which they have no control. I mean, you look at this nonsense that they have. I mean, chaos theory comes out of observing the weather. And this huge problem they have now of trying to predict what the weather is going to do. And they keep saying, well, we're going to get a bigger computer. We're going to get more data. And they're still hopeless. It still isn't happening for them. You know, so, yeah, I mean, this is the beauty of nature. It has a way of going, no, you know, you're just not getting it. You're not doing, I mean, the whole CERN Geneva thing of you know, breaking down the whole molecular thing, they can break it down as far as they like, but they haven't understood. They don't know how to use it. They just waste all this money on creating this massive machinery, and they still can't get to the answer. So their way of thinking is, it's just not going to give us what we actually need. Whereas the Egyptians, I think, because they understood about energies and fluidity and interconnectivity and laws of attraction and all these kind of more subtle as above, below, as below, in all these kind of different things, they were far more advanced than we were. And one of the books that influenced me quite considerably was Fritjof Capra's The Tower Tao of physics, and that's a beautiful book because he is a physicist, but he can see the connections between that and the way the Indians talk about Shiva and how energy flows and that kind of thing. So that I felt he was more on the right tracks in terms of talking about quantum physics.
Absolutely, and one of my favorites is actually Amit Goswami, who has also done extraordinary research into the aspect of about how quantum physics and awareness and self-awareness are so entangled with themselves, and that what quantum physics teaches as its fundamental is really that thought is an essential part. And as you say, thinking, human thought cannot be substituted by machinery which just computes. There's a big there's a big difference there. So we're coming to the end of our show, but what is next for Lucy Wyatt in all of this civilization quest, and specifically what is after Approaching Chaos for you?
Yes, hopefully another book at some point. That would be very, very nice. At the moment, I'm just having a really good time going around the country talking about it. Like, I, love being at Megalithomania, for example. There's various festivals like Sunrise here in the UK, Big Green Gathering, Wilderness. I'm talking at the Crop Circle Conference in August in Marlborough College. And I'm going to be the only female speaker at WEIRD, which is in September in Swindon, which is a big UFO conference. Not that I'm particularly big on UFOs, but I mean, they want to broaden out their thing, talk about ancient culture. So I'm very, very excited about all of that, because every opportunity just to kind of try and shift people's perceptions, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm not going down the route of odd information that's channeled or that I can't actually identify. I'm saying the information is there, but look at it differently. That's what I'm really trying to say. So yeah, having a good time, and maybe I'll get around to writing something again, which would be very nice.
Well, I know that after I finish reading this book, I'm going to have several more hours of questions for you. So I hope you will. I certainly hope you will come back.
I'd love to. Thank you so much. Thank you both of you for giving me the opportunity. It's great to talk to you both.
Absolutely. Our guest today was Lucy Wyatt. Her book is Approaching Chaos: Could an Ancient Archetype Save 21st Century Civilization? Her publisher is very good, because that same publisher has published two books of mine. It's called O-Books. And if you want to listen to this interview again, you can do so in a number of ways. It is the BBS Radio Archive, for which you have to go to bbsradio.com. You will find not only this, but all of our shows, practically all of our shows. You can also get via iTunes, and for iTunes you just go to, well, iTunes, and you search for The Spirit Revolution. And finally, there is our own very special website called thespiritrevolution.com, where you can listen to this and our last five shows, which are always there. And you will also be able to search there for all the topics if you just want to find out what we have been talking about. But this is once again the end of an episode of The Spirit Revolution. Until next week, from the two of us...
The truth against the world.